This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 2020 was a deadly year. Alongside the death toll from the pandemic, though, lies another collective loss, one caused by a sharp rise in violent crime. The homicide rate rose 30% in almost three dozen American cities last year. That's according to a report from the nonpartisan group, the National Commission on COVID-19 and Criminal Justice. So today, we're going to examine the factors behind those statistics. Why did crime rates rise over the course of the pandemic? What happens when fear of gun violence meshes with politics? And most importantly, what can be done to reverse the trend? And we'll start with a voice from Louisiana, the state that's had the nation's highest murder rate for more than 30 years. In 2019, the city of Shreveport reported 37 homicides. But in 2020, that number rose to 66. And already this year, there have been almost 40 homicides in the city.
It's too much, especially in Shreveport. Shreveport is just too small for all the homicides that have happened. They're still happening, and nobody knows nothing. No one is seeing anything. And with everything going on, who could blame them, you know? Who can blame them? Because when they do say something, it's like their voice is not being heard because it's not enough.
This is LaWanda Finney. In 2017, her 19-year-old son Benjamin was killed in a drive-by shooting.
The parents are hurting, the siblings, the brothers and sisters are hurting. Everybody is hurting because when you kill someone, you're taking them from their children, their mom, their dads. And when you do the act of violence and you get caught, you know, you're hurting your mom, your dad, your children.
LaWanda knows many families of the recent murder victims.
It was one that really, really, really touched home. My son's best friend was murdered at a block party. And I'm telling you, they on graduation pictures together. They took trips together. And for this to happen to him, it was just devastating. You know, I was just, you know, lost. I was like, okay, you know, what could we do? We have to do something.
And here's the thing. LaWanda has tried to do something. After her son's death in 2017, she reached out to families touched by gun violence and organized marches called Save Our Sons, Drop the Guns. But she wants even more attention, more tools to change the course of Shreveport's future.
If we don't come up with a solution, we're going to lose a lot of our young black men. And it's scary because none of them is over 30 and the youngest 15. And it's really, really sad. It's hurtful because these are just kids. They're just kids. You know, they're young men, but they're kids.
LaWanda hopes that intervening with the next generation could bring needed change to communities like hers.
The youth that's coming up behind this generation, maybe we can grab a hold of them and let them know this is not the way to go. If we don't get the help that Shreveport needs, it could be worse than what it is. And like I said, it's already up to 40 homicides.
That's LaWanda Finney. She lives in Shreveport, Louisiana. Well, let's turn now to Patrick Sharkey. He's a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University and author of Uneasy Peace, The Great Crime Decline, and the Renewal of City Life and the Next War on Violence. Professor Sharkey, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me on, Meghna.
So first of all, just tell me a little bit about what you hear or how you react to LaWanda Finney's story. Shreveport is not out of the ordinary right now for American cities, is it?
It's not out of the ordinary, and it's really heartbreaking to hear every one of these stories. And then to combine it with the impact on entire communities, you know, with the evidence on how violence affects every child throughout a community, how it affects kids' sleep, how it affects their cognitive functioning, their academic performance, the nature of the community, who invests in the community. I've really, through my research and through stories like LaWanda's, just listening, I've come to think of violence as the fundamental challenge of cities, because violence just destroys entire communities. It makes it really hard to invest in communities, and it really disrupts the trajectories of everyone within communities. So her story goes beyond the victims, and it affects the entire community. And, you know, what she's describing last year happened all over the country. Mm-hmm. So as you mentioned, you know, the surge in violence last year led to this dramatic increase that was experienced in dozens of cities all over the country. Yeah. This was not just a few places.
Well, a little later, we're going to talk about a point that Luanda made as well, which I think is really important when she talked about the intergenerational effects here. But one thing I really hope to achieve with you, Professor Sharkey, is to get an accurate understanding of really what we saw this past year in terms of the rise in violent crime in American cities. Because as you well know, I think there's a kind of headline manipulation that happens in the media that tends to stretch things a little beyond what the truth of the matter is. And I want to push that aside and get to an accurate analysis. So fact check me on something. I've been seeing, you know, headlines touting or not touting, but talking about the fact that gun deaths in 2020 may have reached their highest point in U.S. history. Fact check that. I mean, is that accurate?
Well, the murder rate is nowhere near the highest point in U.S. history. So we have to put this in some historical perspective where, you know, in the early 1990s, the murder rate was up around between 8 and 10 murders for every 100,000 people. That level was all the way from the mid 80s through the early 1990s. Right now, we are going to be right around 6 murders for every 100,000 people in 2020, somewhere around there. So, you know, in historical perspective, we're still living through a relatively safe period. And yet, the murder rate last year was probably the highest of this century so far, and the increase was one of the most substantial increases in violence that we've seen on record, maybe the greatest single year increase. So, you know, you're right to kind of try to avoid the sensational ideas about American carnage. We've seen how that translates into politics, particularly over the past 5 or 6 years. And yet, at the same time, a lot of progressives in particular don't want to acknowledge when violence rises. And because I see this as a crisis, because I see it as something that doesn't just end the lives of thousands of young people, but also exacerbates, amplifies inequality, I think we have to treat it with urgency mm-hmm. and accuracy.
Okay,
you know, so both of those are essential.
Yeah, so let's continue to try and refine that accuracy here. Again, we tend to use that broad brush of crime, violent crime has risen sharply in quote-unquote American cities, but is the current increase evenly distributed across the country?
It's not. I mean, it was widely distributed this past year. There was a huge surge in gun violence that occurred in cities and in small towns all across the country. That said, there are particular places that experience a disproportionate increase. So Chicago, I know we're going to have Eddie Bocanegra who's working in Chicago later on. Chicago had 267 more people shot and killed in 2020. Than in 2019. So that's about a 60% increase. That's just an enormous loss of life. It's a tragedy. And in other cities, it was worse. The increase was about 90% in Milwaukee, 77% in Minneapolis, even 80% in New York City, which is a relatively safe city at this point in the city's history. So this was a widespread change. It occurred even in very cities that have recently been extremely safe, saw this increase in gun violence. And it is important to point out that it's gun violence that rose. It's not all forms of crime that rose last year. In fact, overall crime probably dropped. It is gun violence that surged in cities all over the country.
It's interesting to note, though, that I as far as I understand, I think you shared some statistics with The Atlantic and found that there were some places, Miami, Las Vegas, San Jose, Honolulu, where fatal shootings actually declined. So some exceptions to what seems like the rule of 2020 here. But I think a different pattern holds that we've seen historically, that, you know, even in the cities that we mentioned, New York, Chicago, et cetera, it's a small number of neighborhoods that are disproportionately feeling the impact of this rise in gun violence. And what binds those neighborhoods together?
Yeah, so there are places that have been places of disinvestment, places that over a long stretch of time have not had the basic investment in community institutions. And by that, I mean schools, but also religious congregations, places where parks and playgrounds are not maintained, where libraries don't have the resources they need, where there are not sufficient resources for homelessness, for addiction, for housing affordability in general. So in the US, and I'm going to give a little bit of a broad sweeping argument here, but I think it is central to understanding why communities are vulnerable to violence. In the US, we have not invested in low-income communities of color. And that's been true for a long time, but it's been particularly true in the last 60 years or so. We have not made the kinds of investments that create safe, strong communities. And instead, we have abandoned those communities through federal and state policy and instead invested in the police and the prison. And the police and the prison system have been asked to do way too much. And without the core investments that provide the foundation for every community, neighborhoods are vulnerable to this kind of rise in violence.
Well, Patrick Sharkey, hang on here for just a minute. We have to take a quick break. We are trying to get behind the statistics, the very disturbing statistics about the sharp increase in gun violence in the United States in 2020 and what can be done to reverse the trend. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 2020, the United States, many cities across the country, experienced a historic rise in their homicide rates, in gun violence. And today, we're trying to get beyond those statistics and understand the underlying factors that led to that sharp increase. And I'm joined today by Patrick Sharkey. He's professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. In 2018, he wrote a book titled Uneasy Peace, The Great Crime Decline, The Renewal of City Life, and The Next War on Violence. And Professor Sharkey, before we go any further, I also, you know, again, for the sake of clarity, I just want to understand if an historic trend line that we've seen when it comes to the victims of gun violence in the cities that we've been discussing, it has been particularly young men of color. Is there anything about 2020 that deviated from that trend?
No, it's the same communities and the same segments of the population who have always been victimized by disinvestment in communities that leads to violence. And so, you know, I think the increase in violence last year moved into neighborhoods that hadn't seen gun violence in a long time. So there was this perception. I actually heard a lot of people say to me that, well, there was a armed robbery in my neighborhood. This spike in violence is different than in the past. It's not. It's just grown and expanded. But the same neighborhoods that have always experienced the highest levels of violence experienced it this past year.
So those communities are disproportionately suffering in terms of the victims, the actual murder victims. And do we know about the perpetrators, who they are? Are there any trends there that are important for us to understand?
Well, one of the most well-established findings in criminology is the remarkable overlap between the victims and the perpetrators of gun violence. So these are networks of individuals within communities, again, that are vulnerable to rising violence. And there's enormous overlap between who the victims are and who the perpetrators are. And really, when we analyze this, and Andrew Papakristos does great research on this aspect of violence, the way that it works through networks of individuals within shared spaces. And that's one of the central features of gun violence in particular.
So when you say networks, though, just to be clear, do you mean that the perpetrators and victims often know each other, or they live in the same neighborhood? What does network mean here?
Yeah, meaning they're connected to each other. Okay. They're connected to each other through affiliations with the neighborhoods in which they live, sometimes through gang affiliations, and otherwise through co-offending networks, meaning these are not acts carried out by individuals alone. They're typically about group membership and affiliation and feuds that sometimes lead to gun violence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I know it might seem obvious, but I want listeners to hold that information in their head because it'll be useful in helping to understand what we know works to reduce gun violence. But let's just take a moment to hear about what's been happening in Portland, Oregon, because homicides there rose from 29 homicides in 2019, and they jumped to 53 last year in 2020. And JW Matt Hennessy is a gun violence activist and a pastor at the Vancouver Avenue First Baptist Church.
We got the call that just as I was preparing to teach Bible study that our son was shot and killed on the northeast side of Portland.
And Pastor Hennessy's stepson, Jalen Joachim, was 33. Pastor Hennessy hopes that the pandemic has brought a better understanding to the social conditions that contribute to violence.
What the pandemic has brought through is an understanding that these disparities are real. That oftentimes, when we see the surge in violence on the street, we're talking about people who have come out of very different lives. They've come out of very different experiences, and they've come to the place, oftentimes, of believing there is no hope. These are realities. What are we going to do to help build hope?
That's J.W. Matt Hennessy, a pastor and gun violence activist in Portland, Oregon. Patrick Sharkey, for more than a year now, we have been talking about how the pandemic is a great mirror, great in terms of a large, unavoidable mirror on the realities of American life. How much does that apply to the rise in gun crime in 2020 in this country? What did the pandemic do to accelerate that growth?
Yeah, it's a great way to put it, because what happened last year was a series of shocks that eroded community life. You know, when social life shut down in March, it meant that the institutions of communities also shut down. And so when the pastor says these young people don't have any hope, he's right. There is a sense of being abandoned, a sense of being on their own, a sense of having to navigate through very disadvantaged environments without mentorship, without support, without having a place to go. And I think that was just amplified throughout the pandemic when schools shut down. That means young people don't have a place to go during the day. After school programs shut down. playgrounds shut down, then summer jobs programs shut down and community centers. So this left people, not just young people, but particularly, you know, young adults without the core institutions that structure daily life, without places to go, without people who are looking out for them. And these are what the institutions with a community do. And so when we do get into this discussion about what comes next, you know, my argument is we have to recognize, and a bright light was shown on this point this past year, but we have to recognize the people and the institutions that look out over a community and try to make sure no one falls through the cracks, try to make sure everyone is cared for, that public spaces don't go downhill, that kids don't get into trouble. And a lot of those institutions shut down in March. I think it's a big reason why we saw this breakdown of social life and a lot of communities became even more vulnerable to rising violence.
You know, it makes me think about the title of your book, Uneasy Peace, because in this case, I see the pandemic as kind of like a hurricane almost, that if you know, it damaged everyone and everything. But if your house, you know, your community was built on a solid foundation, right, those strong institutions that you're talking about, the hurricane may have damaged the house, but largely the structure held together. But if your community didn't have as many of those strong institutions, right, not enough investment in schools to find ways for, you know, the schools to reach out into the community when they had to shut their buildings down, right? You know, and you talk about libraries, public spaces. If those institutions aren't there, that underlying foundation is very fragile. And when the hurricane comes through, it just blows the whole thing down. So to me, that's what has been revealed here, is what you're saying is that uneasy peace that you're talking about was perhaps destined to break down because the foundational strengths of the communities were not attended to.
It's a really powerful way to put it. I titled the book Uneasy Peace because even though it was a historic decline of violence and one that had these enormous benefits that were experienced by the most disadvantaged segments of the population, the most disadvantaged communities. So this is a breakthrough. We should celebrate it. And yet we never took the steps to build stronger communities, to deal with the fundamental problem here, which is extreme urban inequality and disinvestment in core community institutions. We never took that next step of building on the drop in violence and then changing the way that we dealt with violence, moving away from mass incarceration, no longer asking police to dominate public space through any means necessary, and instead investing in core community institutions to create stronger neighborhoods that would no longer be vulnerable to a rise in violence. So it was fragile. Even when I wrote the book, it was one of the safest years in the history of the nation when I started writing the book in 2014, finally came out in 2018. And I called it Uneasy Peace because I knew it was fragile. Mm-hmm. It was difficult to sustain.
Well, so you talked about how part of the one of the factors in the decrease in crime that we saw, you just used the phrase police dominating public spaces. I have to ask, though, the increase in policing and greater police presence over the past many years has contributed to a decrease in the violent crime that we're talking about. And many people do wonder, what impact did the protests from last summer have, the Black Lives Matter protests have? What impact did the pulling back of policing from these very neighborhoods that we're talking about have on the massive uptick in gun violence? How do you interpret that?
So there's extremely strong evidence that when more police are on the street, violence falls. And, you know, this is evidence that is it's one of the strongest findings in criminology. Let me say two points that are often left out of this discussion. One is the harm generated by asking the police to dominate public space. And so that harm has become very visible as more videos of police shootings and police brutality in general have proliferated through cell phones and out to the world. But it also comes just in the everyday impact of young people walking through their communities and feeling like suspects, not feeling like members of the community. And we can see the tangible consequences of that for children's outcomes. There's great work. Abigail Sewell has done great work showing the negative consequences for young people's mental health. There's other work on their academic performance if they've been stopped by police officers, if they have been profiled in their communities. So that's one point. So policing does reduce crime, does reduce violence, but it comes with all of these costs. And those costs translate into mass incarceration. The other point I'll make very quickly is that it is not just the police that reduce crime. So there's more and more evidence showing that community organizations, like the one that we'll hear about when you bring Mr. Bocanegra on, community organizations played a central role in contributing to the decline of violence in the 1990s and have never gotten the credit that they deserve in contributing to the crime decline. Investments in those kinds of organizations, the organizations that look out over a community to make sure everybody's safe, have never been made in the same way that we've invested in the police. So when I look at kind of what the next model should look like, what I'm arguing is that we should not just try to dismantle police departments. We should instead begin to invest in a serious way in the other set of institutions that have shown how effective they are in controlling violence and that come without the harms of intensive, aggressive policing.
Well, we are talking this hour about what's behind the massive surge in gun violence in the United States in 2020. You're listening to Patrick Sharkey. He's author of Uneasy Peace, The Great Crime Decline, The Renewal of City Life, and The Next War on Violence. And Patrick, actually, you've given me the perfect segue to bring in Eddie Bocanegra now, who joins us from Chicago. He's senior director of the Rapid Employment and Development Initiative, or Ready Chicago, at the Heartland Alliance. Mr. Bocanegra, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Megna.
So first of all, you heard Patrick Sharkey talk about the many hundreds more people who were killed in Chicago last year. I just want to first get a sense of how you feel about it, what you think is behind it, what has Chicago life been like over the past 15 months?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing that I'd like to just highlight is that I really sincerely wish that government, both local and federal, and philanthropy would be actually listening to some of the amazing findings and recommendations that Professor Sharkey has just outlined today. I would say that the field of gun violence in itself has been a very stagnant field in many ways. And in large part, it's because of the systems that continue to perpetuate this level of lack of service or inability to promote what seems to be working in terms of best practice or evidence. And what we're seeing here in Chicago is a mixture of a number of different things. We're seeing that definitely, as Professor Sharkey just mentioned, we've seen close to a 60% increase of gun violence last year to the year before that. And that's acknowledging in 2016, we had over 750 homicides as well, the largest number of homicides that we had seen in almost 20 years, in two decades. And that really prompted philanthropy to come together at the local level to figure out how do we address this issue, this public health issue. And in many ways, we started to support traditional kind of levels of support services like outreach, engagement, intervention services. But then it gave us an opportunity, which gave birth to Ready Chicago, to leverage some of the best practices or models or evidence that's out there that has demonstrated to help reduce gun violence. And in large part, that came through the University of Chicago's Crime Lab. And that was our partnership with Heartland Alliance, which is the parent company that I serve. And at the end of the day, we know that jobs have proven to help reduce gun violence. And we know that cognitive behavioral therapy with young people has also helped to reduce gun violence. And so the idea was to merge those two principles, pepper it with a number of other support services like housing, individual mental health services, and do a randomized controlled trial study that's never been done with this population to really demonstrate or learn, you know, does this intervention really work? Mm. What seems to be working? What's not working? And ideally make recommendations based on these findings.
Yeah.
And so, yes.
Well, so I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but we do have to take a break here in just about 30 seconds. So I'm going to move towards doing that. And then when we come back from the break, Eddie Bocanegra, I want to hear some more specifics about exactly, you know, the work that is happening in Chicago that these studies are proving can be effective. So specific examples when we come back. So Eddie Bocanegra is Senior Director of Ready Chicago at the Heartland Alliance, and Patrick Sharkey is with us as well, Professor of Sociology and Public Affairs at Princeton University. And we are talking today about trying to understand what's driving the sharp rise, the very sharp rise in increase in gun violence in America, and solutions to turn the tide. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're trying to understand what's behind, not the one thing, but the many things that are behind the sharp rise in the homicide rate and gun violence in the United States in 2020. I'm joined today by Patrick Sharkey. He's professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University and author of Uneasy Peace, The Great Crime Decline, The Renewal of City Life, and The Next War on Violence. Eddie Bocanegra also joins us as well from Chicago. He's senior director of the Rapid Employment and Development Initiative, or Ready Chicago, at the Heartland Alliance. And Eddie Bocanegra, before we get to some of the, you know, the specific programs that you've tested there in Chicago, I did actually want to take a step back for a moment and ask you to walk us through some of the stories that you've heard from people that you've worked with there about, you know, their very decision to carry a gun and then perhaps use it in a situation that they may not have done before. And the reason why I ask that is because it seems pretty evident that we have years of data now that shows that violence then begets more violence. So I'm trying to understand the decision making there to then see, like, where in that cycle the interventions can be most most effective. So can you talk about that? Like, folks you have worked with, what do they tell you about why they're carrying guns to begin with?
Sure, Meghna, and it's an excellent question. I think, you know, one of the things that I just want to point out, right, that, you know, as Americans or as human beings, we tend to fail in putting ourselves in the other person's shoes, and we easily criticize what we don't always know, and we assume, right, that people have options or that people choose to do what they choose to do because they wanted to. And I think, as Professor Sharkey mentioned just a moment ago too, you know, what we're dealing with right now is also this issue around racial and social and economic justice, you know, the lack of, and that many of our communities in which we see a lot of concentrated violence, they're still recovering from the 1960s when we had the civil rights movements. You know, I could give you examples in Chicago, like in the North Lawndale community, where we have a high recidivism, where we have a high increase of gun violence, and also where we have over 70% of the adults there between the ages of 18 and 36 actually have a felony conviction. So if you put all that together, you know, what are the true options that many of our residents actually have? And even despite the fact that last year, our Chicago Police Department took out of the streets over 11,000 guns. Mm. 11,000 guns. We have in this country a gun issue. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that I simply want to point out. But the fact, the mere fact that, you know, many of our participants that we work with or many of the folks that are living in these communities feel that they have to carry a gun to protect themselves, that's the deeper question. Like, why is it? Which is what you're asking. And in large part, it's because they don't trust the public safety systems that are in place right now, particularly when many of these systems or institutions have oppressed them as well, when they've seen, you know, these same systems incarcerate their fathers and their grandfathers. So that's one issue, is a lack of trust there. I think the other issue is that most of these individuals who feel they have to carry a gun don't always use it for the attempt of harming someone else, but because they feel often their lives are being threatened. And so when they don't believe or feel that there's a system in place that could actually protect them from some of those harms, that's a challenge. And they often have to navigate, you know, some of those decisions. And, you know, unfortunately or fortunately for many Americans, we don't always have to kind of grapple with that. And right. that's one of the main reasons why so many young people feel they have to carry a gun.
Right. So, Patrick Sharkey, let me turn back to you for a second here, because we're going to want to hear from Eddie Bokenegger in a second about, you know, interventions by providing more jobs, as he talked about before, and cognitive behavioral therapy. We're going to get to that in a second. But he's also brought up a really important point about trust, right? And trust in the very institutions we were talking about earlier, and a general feeling of the lack of safety being one of the things that's prolonging this cycle. I mean, how do you break that cycle when something as fundamental as trust or lack of it is part of the problem?
That is a major part of the problem. And I think it was amplified and exacerbated this past year when, you know, a large segment of the population felt like they were on their own, felt like they were completely abandoned by their government, felt like society was breaking down because institutions were, in fact, shutting down. And so I think that feeling is widespread. I think it's been around for a long time, but it has spread to a larger segment of the population as, you know, the nation has become aware of the scale of mass incarceration. So the people that Eddie Bocanegra has been working with have known about mass incarceration. The rest of the country, I don't think, was fully aware of that. This, you know, the level of incarceration has risen by 700% since the 1970s. I don't think the rest of the country was aware of how people are treated by the police on a day-to-day basis. I know I certainly was not prepared to watch those videos and see what's going on. And I spend my life studying this. You know, it's different to experience it on a day-to-day basis. And there is no blame that should go to people who feel like they have been oppressed by the institution of police, who feel like they don't trust this institution, who feel like they are not protected by this institution, because that's been true for a long period of time. It's not true everywhere. There are lots of places where interactions between the police and residents are respectful and cordial, and the police department is doing a great job. But there are communities across the country that have never been protected mm-hmm. by the police, that have never been experienced a close, trusting relationship with police. And that was amplified this past year. It led to a series of changes, both where police changed the way they interact with residents and where residents step back and decide to check out and no longer call the police and no longer provide information. And that's part of what happened after the protests. This confluence of factors certainly played a role in contributing to the surge of gun violence.
Right. And as you said earlier, it's not that policing is not part of the overall solution set, but it's the models of policing that need reexamination here. Eddie Bocanegra, let's get back into that solution space, okay? Because you said some very interesting things earlier about pilot programs that combined jobs, which seems rather obvious, is must be part of the solution, and also things like cognitive behavioral therapy. Can you give us some examples of things that you find that Ready Chicago has found that are working?
Yeah, well, I would I will feel bad at myself if I don't actually point out one other thing in response to what we just shared too just a moment ago, is that I think if you think about gun violence in general, we know in the science and the research when Professor Sharkey mentioned Andy Papacristo, like we know that there is a small group of folks that are the drivers of gun violence. And traditionally, what we tend to focus our resources is preventative efforts, particularly with young people, which is great. We need that. But too often, it's the adults, those that are 18 years and older, that often are overlooked. They continue to be marginalized. And I want to point out this a snapshot to give you an example to you and your audience and who it is Ready Chicago is really serving. And I tend to look at our participants as if these are individuals who have a stage 3 colon cancer diagnosis, right? Meaning they have about a 50, 60% chance of beating this if they get the treatment that they actually need. So the odds are not always in their favor, to be quite honest. And it also depends on who's providing the surgery and the aftercare. So I just want to point this picture. But on average, our participants in Ready Chicago have 17 to 18 arrests. On average, they had 4 to 5 felony arrests. 80% of our participants, according to police and hospital data, have been victims of violence. They've been shot, stabbed, or assaulted. As a matter of fact, over one third of our participants are survivors of gun violence. Hmm. This, again, supports what Professor Sharkey pointed out, that too often, you know, the perpetrators of violence are also at one point or another have been victims themselves. The other thing that I'll point out is that 80% of our men are both couch surfing, which means there's unstable housing. 60% of our men have children. So think about the opportunity to stop the cycle of violence there. And that 80% of our participants have only completed a 10th grade level, but they're really reading at the 5th and 6th grade level. Mm-hmm. So even within marginalized communities, we continue to marginalize even within the marginalized. So it's really important that when we think about gun violence, who are we really referring to? What is the uniform definition of how we're describing high-risk individuals? And across the country, I would say, Megan, that we don't have a clear definition. And that would even go for institutions like, you know, NIJ, which is the Institute for Justice, who often support research, and other institutions, right, that I would make the argument that we need to do a better job to really spelling out these high-risk individuals and the kind of interventions that are needed to support them. And that brings me to your question around Ready Chicago.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, we are saturating our participants with resources. We are providing employment for them in the form of transitional jobs. In other words, we're providing skill sets. We are creating a pathway for academic attainment so they could read better, so that we could place them in better positions, so we could get them certified in specific licensing. We are supporting them in removing some of the barriers of employment. So we work on a lot of policy issues, including removing some of their records expungements. But ultimately, what we're seeing and where we put most of our resources at has been on the cognitive behavioral therapy, or as we also call it, cognitive behavioral intervention services. And this is the idea of being able to disrupt the way they think between impulse and action. CBT or CBI, as we call it, is the wedge. And we do a lot of scenario planning throughout the week. We provide an hour and a half at a time, and we compensate them for that. You know, so just even the fact of me saying that we compensate them for their participant, and many of your viewers' eyes would say, why would you do that? Why would you pay them to do that? And the truth is, it's less costly for us to do so than have to pay now than we would in the future.
Yeah.
And I would also say that according to our early analysis of this program, again, through the University of Chicago's Crime Lab, the program itself has paid for itself as of a year ago. Not to mention that we are seeing positive gains between those that are in the treatment group versus the control group. And that is worth celebrating. And that is what we need to continue to promote across the country as well.
So, Eddie, we've just got about 3 or 4 minutes left here, and I have a couple last questions for both you and Patrick Sharkey here. But the suite of programs you just described sounds incredibly effective here. What would it take to scale it up? You know, to first of all, just, you know, across the neighborhoods in Chicago that need it, or even across the country?
Well, I think before we scale up, we continue to have to figure out what's working, what's not working. Mm-hmm. We have a good indication of that through Ready Chicago, but we also have other evidence and other programs across the country, too. I think what's really needed is a political will. It's this you know, we continue to look at models, which I won't name any of them, that were 20, 30 years, they might have been effective. Maybe there was some mixed, you know, data around it, but we continue to promote that. You know, policymakers continue to use those models within the White House and other institutions, right, to support those models. So we need political will to support, you know, other kind of services and interventions.
Are you seeing any sign of a new kind of political will? I mean, the Biden jobs plan, you actually were invited to the White House, right? I mean, the Biden jobs plan has $5 billion in it for gun violence prevention programs.
Correct. So through the Fund Peace Coalition, I would say there's been a lot of work that's gone behind that. And let me just say this, that I remain very optimistic, right, in terms of the president's direction and leadership around gun violence. The fact that he is announcing as a public health issue is phenomenal. And the fact that he's been able to trying to push Congress to support a $5 billion request to support gun violence as well in his first 100 days, again, that is phenomenal. No other president has ever done that. And the last thing that I would say related to that as well is that, again, if we are thinking about the economic engines of our country, if we're thinking about police and public safety, we have to address these things. And one of the ways that we could address this is through jobs. In particular around this American Jobs Act, we have to create more safer communities so that we could get more of our American citizens like out and working. That is essential for our economic engine.
Mm. Well, Patrick Sharkey, in the last 2 minutes that we have here, you know, I'm thinking about the potential of the kinds of programs that, you know, Eddie Bocanegra is describing here, presuming that as they continue their studies, the effectiveness is proven. But ultimately, we also have to deal with the reality of American politics, right? Because politics can be part of the solution. It can also inhibit the solution. And very quickly, as we've seen in the past, what we've seen in the past is happening again, that this issue of the rise in crime and gun violence is being rapidly politicized. Are you concerned that could derail the kind of progress that the nation otherwise needs to make?
I am. You know, when violence is rising, it makes all these discussions more difficult. And there's good reason for that. You know, when there are more guns on the street, policing is a more dangerous job. More police are shot. Police shoot more people in places where there are more guns. And the public becomes more punitive, meaning the public starts to support harsher policies toward crime in times when violence is rising. So it makes everything more difficult. We have this history in the U.S. because we never invested in communities when the problem of concentrated poverty and urban inequality started to become more and more extreme in the 1960s. When we did not choose to invest in communities, we instead took this alternative approach of investing in the police and the prison. And that is now our knee-jerk reaction when violence is rising. So it makes the politics extremely difficult. But like Eddie Bocanegra, I'm extremely optimistic because this proposal, and it's only a proposal at this point, but the $5 billion in the jobs plan represents a fundamental departure from federal intervention into the problem of violence and crime. The federal government has never made this kind of commitment to community organizations. So this is at least the sign of a first step in that direction.
Right. And in the long run, though, for this to really work, that commitment has to be sustained. And I'm not sure if American politics is built to make that kind of sustained commitment, but we shall see. Patrick Sharkey, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University and author of Uneasy Peace, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
And Eddie Bocanegra, senior director of the Rapid Employment and Development Initiative, or Ready Chicago. Mr. Bocanegra, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.